Jalakamarangakunjabihari Kopi janna balaka girvade dari Jalakamarangakunjabihari Gopi janna balava girivare dari Jamuna tira vanachari Jalakka marubva kundabihari Gopi janna bhalava girvagadari Jamuna tira banachari Jai Krishna Balaram Jai Krishna Balaram Krishna Balaram Jai Krishna Balaram Jai
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, The Departure of Lord Krishna for Dwarka, text 29. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Vasudevaya. Vavirya-shu kena kritak svayambare. Pramatyacharya pramukhan hishushminha. Pradyumna sambam apsita dhyopara. Yaschahrita bhoma bhade sahasrashah. Please chant. I'll just read them. Yah, the lady, Virya, prowess, Shukena, by payment of the price. Hritaha, taken away by force. Swayamvare, in the open selection of the bridegroom. Pramatya, harassing. Chaidya, King Shishupal. Pramukhan, headed by he positively. Shushminaha, all very powerful. Pradyumna, Krishna's son. Samba, Amba, Sutta Adayaha, children. Aparaha, other ladies. Yaha, those. Cha, also. Ahritaha, similarly brought. Boma Vadhe, after killing kings. Sahasrashaha, by the thousands. Translation report by Srila Prabhupada. The children of these ladies are Pradyumna, Samba, Amba, etc. Ladies like Rukmini, Satchabama, and Jambavati were forcibly taken away by him from their Swayamvara ceremonies after he defeated many powerful kings, headed by Shishupal. And other ladies were also forcibly taken away by him after he killed Bhaumasura and thousands of his assistants. All of these ladies are glorious. Purport. Exceptionally qualified daughters of powerful kings were allowed to make a choice of their own bridegrooms in open competition, and such ceremonies were called Swayambara, or selection of the bridegroom. Because the Swayambara was an open competition between the rival and valiant princes, such princes were invited by the father of the princess, and usually there were regular fights between the invited princely order in a sporting spirit. But it so happened that sometimes the belligerent princes were killed in such marriage fighting, and the victorious prince was offered the trophy princess for whom so many princes died. Rukmini, the principal queen of Lord Krishna, was the daughter of the king of Vidarbha, who wished that his qualified and beautiful daughter be given away to Lord Krishna. But her eldest brother wanted her to be given away to King Shishupal, who happened to be a cousin of Krishna. So there was open competition, and as usual, Lord Krishna emerged successful after harassing Shishupal and other princes by his unrivaled prowess. Rukmini had 10 sons, like Pradyumna. There were other queens also taken away by Lord Krishna in a similar way. Full description of this beautiful booty of Lord Krishna will be given in the 10th canto. There were 16,100 beautiful girls who were daughters of many kings and were forcibly stolen by Bhaumasura, who kept them captive for his carnal desire. These girls prayed piteously to Lord Krishna for their deliverance, and the merciful Lord, called by their fervent prayer, released them all by fighting and killing Bhaumasura. All these captive princes were then accepted by the Lord as his wives, although, in the estimation of society, they were all fallen girls. The all-powerful Lord Krishna accepted the humble prayers of these girls and married them with the adoration of queens. So altogether, Lord Krishna had 16,108 queens at Dwarka, and in each of them he begot 10 children. All these children grew up, and each had as many children as the father. The aggregate of the family number numbered in the millions. You can look it up in another canto. So it's a little hard for me to picture Lord Krishna as a king in Dwarka. We used to have a picture back there, and it did show him sitting on a couch, and he had a very bejeweled sword by his side and a big helmet and sitting on these fancy cushions. And I don't know, it's just hard for me to picture him in this scene with so many princesses and valiant clothes and everything like that. But he is the origin of everything. So he is also the origin of family life and of this bond with children. So we can understand that he's extraordinary, though. He's beyond the mundane thought of family life. Here we see 16,108 queens. And of course, we know he had a palace for each one. And here we're hearing that he had so many, many, many children. I mean, most of us don't have pictures of, you know, Krishna and Satyabhama on our walls, do we? Or, you know, maybe we have Krishna and Rukmini Dwarkadish from L.A. or something like that, but most of us don't have pictures. Oh, there it is, yeah. But most of us think of Krishna more in the Vrindavan scene, but I kind of calculated that Krishna must have been in married life for about 100 years. So he, it's a big chunk of his pastimes were in Dwarka, and here we are hearing about some of them. In different cultures, if you studied around the world, you'd find a big variety of matrimonial traditions and values. And I think it would be interesting to kind of compare them all, but I didn't get into that. But in general, the Vedic culture has a big chapter of their society is on marriage. And we all know that if you ever go at a certain time in India, I think it's springtime, the early springtime, all along the road, all you see are just marriages, one after another, huge, brilliant lights, and they have these big, huge halls for them. And it's a big, big affair. And it's a great concern for many of the fathers that their kid, their daughters isn't married. Even I think Prabhupada said that he was, you know, he was worried at some time that his daughter wasn't married. So this is going on still today, that it's a big samskara. And when I think of samskaras, I think of scars, that they're actually very deep impressions that you never forget. It has a story behind it. And so this, especially marriage, is a big thing. It goes on for weeks in India and in the tradition. I remember Lakshmani and Malati got invited to one of Radhanath Swami's disciples who was getting somebody married. And they were flown in from wherever they were in the world. And they went to this place, and the minute they drived up, they were giving new cloth, new saris for each day, for each thing that went on during the day. They had a change of clothes. Every single person got it. And then there was a big polo match in the middle of the day. And they, I mean, it was just like, oof, I mean, way beyond we could ever imagine. So these were big affairs, so that you would never forget that this was a lifetime vow that was never to be broken. And I mean, now in the Vedic cultures, it's probably a little controversial, but it was accepted that way. We can see that even like the arranged marriage, that was also very accepted at that time. Prabhupada said that he was, I think he was betrothed at like 11 years old, his wife was like 6 or 7, something like that. So Prabhupada accepted it, and this was kind of the standard. And I still I think some marriages are arranged and is still going on, but the marriage vow is taken very seriously. And here we can see that Krishna took it very seriously. He married all these different young ladies for different purposes. Because it bears a great weight on the society, marriages, if they're not strong and they're not predominant in society, then we hear that there's an unwanted population. And there's disruption in the homes, disruptions in many people's lives for their whole life. So we understand that when Prabhupada came here to the West, it was a whole different scenario. He came and saw that the men and women were all kind of had loose relationships, and no one took anything very seriously or very responsible as far as a marriage vow, just living together, and very relaxed family relationships. Kids were leaving home, no big deal, you know, at a young age, as soon as they could. And the lack of respect for families, members, he was pretty shocked at that also. Very different than the Vedic standard. So he had to deal with that, and then he had to deal with, you know, the divorce situation. Of course, in the Vedic culture, Prabhupada said there wasn't even a word for it. That it just didn't happen. It was just, you know, that was your vow, and that was it. You get what you get, and you deal with what you get. I remember we were in Mayapur, and Sridhar Maharaj, the Jolly Swami, he was very sick, and it was very soon before he left. We took the girls, the ashram, to visit him, and he was still very jolly, and he was trying to give some advice to the girls, and he said, just pick any men, they're all the same, you know, they just pick one and you'll be fine. Anyway, of course he was sannyas, didn't realize it. These days, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when I was a kid in school and things like that, if it was like divorce was like hush, hush. You didn't say that word in public. It was like, you know, it was not heard of. It was just very, wasn't accepted totally. But now, it's, you know, it's like, how many divorces have you had, you know? So it's when things get a little uncomfortable, And when the things are inconvenient and the sense gratification isn't there, then simply change partners. And so Prabhupada was very against this. And he was very firm in the beginning. He actually married the couples to avoid illicit connection. He said, okay, then you all just get married. And he performed, actually, marriages in person. And then it came to the point where some wanted divorce. And that's when he made a couple of exceptions, and then after that he just kind of washed his hands of the whole thing. He was disappointed and said, I'm not marrying anyone anymore. You all deal with it. And so that was unfortunate. But Krishna set the standard. 16,108 wives. Of course, Prabhupada nipped that in the bud. He said, one wife only. First of all, it's illegal, and you can't even maintain one around here, what less two or three or a thousand. So Krishna set a standard, but it's not to be imitated. But it is. We could see that when Narada Muni, he visited all the palaces to see what Krishna was doing in all the palaces with the queens. And he realized that they all were satisfied. Every single queen was totally satisfied. And he was faithful to all of them. And gave them all wonderful children and everything. So this is the standard we should maintain, is to make sure that our family members are Krishna conscious and very satisfied. And so here we're reading about some of the marriage maneuvers that Krishna performed. Pretty outstanding, pretty much, we definitely can't imitate these. But it was the standard in those days that if there was the elite club of the kings and princes and princesses, that a princess could choose her husband under certain circumstances, and the father would arrange sometimes competition. And so there is one queen that was pretty mellow in the marriage thing, and that was Bhadra. Bhadra actually had a crush on Krishna. She had heard about Krishna. They'd never seen him, but she had heard about him, how wonderful he was and everything, and she just had a crush on him, and her father realized that, and so he made some arrangements. It actually was an arranged marriage by her father that Krishna would come and marry her. And he did that. And then her father gave a huge dowry that would put to shame anything that we've ever heard of here. And there was a big pomp and ceremony, and that was one of his marriages, one of the more calm ones. And then there was here it's mentioned about the Swayambhara, where you get to choose by the different princes that were invited to come. And so there was this one, Lakshmana, and her father arranged interesting competition. It's similar to how Draupadi got taken away by the Pandavas. And that was when Lakshmana's father arranged for the fish again, for the fish to be up and the reflection in the water. But this time, the fish was covered with a cloth. So you're not going to get a very good reflection in the water, but you still have to look at the reflection. You don't look up, you look at the reflection, and you shoot your arrow and try to pierce the eye of the fish. So there were many princes there, and they looked at the situation, and some of them, first of all, couldn't even get the bow tied up, and so they went home. They went home with their tail between their legs. And then there's some, they could string the bow, and they would shoot, and they'd miss the target. They all left. They went home to bears. And then another one, they could string the bow, shoot the target, but none of them, even Arjuna shot and hit the target, but he didn't hit the eye. And so then only Krishna kept step forward, of course, no problem, shooting the eye of the fish. And And she came forward, Lakshmana came forward with all her beautiful bangles and everything, and gorgeous, and put the garland on Krishna, and then Krishna looked over and saw all the princes getting kind of red in the face, a little fumy, a little angry, and so he says, Daruka, quick, come. And he put Lakshmana on the chariot, picked up his sharanga bow, and they took off, and the princes followed, and he ended up having to cut off some of their arms, some of their hands, some of their legs, some of their heads, but it was just like taking a lion taking a deer away from a pack of deer. She just was taken away and then married very ceremoniously. Rukmini, it's mentioned here, you all know that story, and she also had a crush on Krishna and wrote that letter, and Krishna kidnapped her, and he also, there were some objections to his catching her from having to marry that creep Shishupal. So they weren't very happy with that, especially her brother Rukmini, and ended up that Krishna spanked him, didn't kill him, but spanked him, and sent him. He couldn't even go home because he vowed he wouldn't go home, so he had to go somewhere else for a long time. So that was that story. And then there was another competition, a very interesting competition. This was King Nagajit. And he had a daughter, Sacha, who was of marriageable age and had a lot of princes wanting to marry her. So he made a tough competition. He got seven really ferocious bulls and put them in a ring, and the competitor would have to tame them and bring them down. And so some of the princes came and looked at the situation, and every attempt they got struck by the bulls. If you've ever seen a bullfight, not a pretty scene. Pretty scary. Actually, near the temple in Buega, outside of Madrid, I've been there. There's a little teeny town, and they actually have that crazy festival where everybody runs in the street, and then they let the bulls out to run behind them, and you're supposed to outrun the bulls. I mean, come on. You see the people flying, you know, and getting gored and everything. Anyway, competition, crazy. Anyway, they were pretty much defeated by all the bulls, and then Krishna came, and it was like play toys for him. He just, you know, he got their rings and he tied them all up and calmed them down and won the hand of Sacha. And her father also gave a wonderful dowry. But the princes were not happy with that situation, and they also started to attack, but Krishna defeated them all. So there was some bloodshed again. A little bit more civilized marriage was with Kalindi, who had some nice living arrangement inside the Jamuna River, and she was personification of the beautiful Jamuna. And she had a desire, a very deep desire, to marry Krishna. And, of course, Krishna knew this, and so there was an arrangement where Arjuna and Krishna were out practicing hunting, and they were thirsty and went down to the Jamuna. And Arjuna was bending down getting some water, and all of a sudden he sees this beautiful, beautiful young lady. And he actually commented, "Oh, you look like you're a marriageable age. Who do you belong to? You know, who are you? You're really beautiful." And then she told her intense desire to marry Lord Krishna. And he said, "Well, actually, I can arrange that. He's right over here." And so he went over and introduced them. And Krishna was very happy to accept her as his wife. So he took her back, and her comment was that, "I am just so happy to become a sweeper in Lord Krishna's home. And he's so kind that he will accept me as a, well, he will treat me like a wife." So she was very humble, very just happy to be in Krishna's presence. And then there's a two-in-one. Krishna gets two wives in one pastime, and that's of the Shyamataka jewel. And so that story is quite complicated, but it ends up that Satyabhama's father had this jewel, the Shyamataka jewel, and it got stolen. And in doing so, his brother was killed, Prasena. And they thought it was Krishna. He thought it was Krishna. And so he was very upset, and Krishna heard about that. Oh, this is not right. I didn't do it. I've got to, you know, honor my name, so I've got to go find that jewel and give it back and prove that I didn't kill Prasena. I didn't take the jewel. And so he went and he found the jewel that had been taken by one Jambavan, who's kind of, I guess he's kind of monkey-like. Something like that. A bear, okay. Hairy guy. Hairy Krishna. And he had taken the jewel that was from the lion that killed Prasena, anyway, and gave it to his kids to play with. And so when Krishna found the jewel, he was very happy, but Jambavan was not happy. That, who are you? Come in here, take this my play toy from the kid. And so he got angry and challenged Krishna, and they fought 27 days. And then Jambavan, who was actually a follower of Lord Ram, loved Lord Ram, started to think that maybe this must be Lord Ram in some incarnation, because no one could fight me for 27 days. And so then he found that out, and he returned the jewel to Krishna, and also his daughter, because he felt very bad about fighting with his lord. So he offered his daughter Jambavati, and Krishna was glad to accept. And so then he took the jewel back, and Satyabhama's father was very ashamed that I accused you of this, and I was wrong. But he felt so bad. He says, "Please take my daughter also." And so Satyabhama was given also to Krishna, and so he got two in one with that one. And then there's Mitravinda. She had a swayamvara, and her father invited many princesses and Krishna also. And Krishna ended up defeating all the princes. And he caught her up because he could see some adverse signs, and caught her up and took her away. And he ended up having to defeat even her brother. So she was also one of Krishna's queens. I was in L.A. one time, and Prabhupada was there. And Prabhupada was telling some of these stories about the bloodshed that one would have when he would, you know, prove his prowess to take the lady as his wife. And so he was saying that, yes, and they would take, he said, they would take the blood from the defeated prince and put it in their hair. And he went like that. He says, that's why the women have that red kumkum now, he says, but it was really blood. He went like this, and they would put it in his hair. And then, you can imagine the woman, but wow, yeah, now I really got me a husband. No one's going to do it. You know? And so he goes, is that all right? We can do that? And everybody goes, I didn't know what to say. And Prabhupada laughed. But it was nice pastime. So Prabhupada acknowledged that this did go on, and that's why the ladies put the red mark in the hair, but I guess she just put some paint or something like that. I was reading the Chaitanya Bhagavad also that Lord Chaitanya, his mother, Sachimata, actually had a matchmaker. So in those days, there were matchmakers. Isn't there some story, a song, and matchmaker, something? Anyway, it's many traditions there are matchmakers. And so they helped with Lord Chaitanya's arranging his marriage.
That was Banamali Vishwamitra.
Uh-huh. And then Prabhupada mentioned it was astrology. It was always like, you know, people always said to Prabhupada, you know, should we use astrology, you know, and this and that. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta was so good at it and everything. And Prabhupada said you could use it for marriage, just for compatibility. He says that's good. And so I know that sometimes happens, just to make sure everything's all right. And then there's the pastime of, actually, we'll get to that in a few minutes. But in ISKCON, the householders, this didn't really happen. Well, in the very beginning, Prabhupada, like I said, saw the matches that were already going on and made them get married. But he was actually very proud of his householders because they were preachers. And they would go, and they started the London Temple. Prabhupada was so proud of them. He said that they were better than the sannyasis who had tried to in London to start temples. So he was very proud that his married couples were taking up that that sword to help with this movement. But I can say for many of the householders that we had our vanaprast first. That actually we couldn't think about kids. We were married so that we could start temples. And so we went, so many stories of us, you know, okay, well, we need a temple here, so the temple president would call up this temple over here and match the two and say, okay, and then they should get married and go start this temple. And this actually went on. So we lived very austerely. We lived in the temple. We didn't have homes. If we lived with our husband, it just had a curtain in between the different rooms of the couples. So we had our vanaprast first, and then we had our household life later, which was topsy-turvy, backwards. But I don't know if we can ever figure out the percentage of those marriages that lasted, maybe 50-50, I don't know, of the arranged marriages. But we did what Prabhupada wanted, and we helped him with his mission. It's a little different these days. We tried some arranged marriages in the very beginning with the second generation. Didn't get off the ground. Nope. Just didn't make it. So now you can go online. I think they have websites so you can find your partners that way. Or you can go to the university in Belgium, or you can go to the bus tours and find your mate, or you can go to different seminars or coolie mailers or whatever. There's different ways that it goes on now. But the facilities are there, and as most all, Prabhupada said, all the women should get married and all the men should stay celibate. How's that going to work? Don't know. It's going on. Krishna is setting the example that it's natural. It's a natural thing that that there will be nice couples. Even in the bushes in my front yard, there's a nice little pair of cardinals, and they actually have their spouse for a lifetime. They don't change anything. They have their one. I see them all the time. They have their nests every year and everything. So this is a nice example that it is natural, and that we should make it as Krishna conscious as possible. Nowadays, some of the old Vedic standards are being challenged. I know whenever there's some weird thing going on in India that, you know, someone's being forced now to get married or forced to change their religion because they're marrying someone else, it's big news, you know. So it is definitely being challenged these days. But the norm was that you would, that it was unacceptable that if, here's described in this purport, that it's unacceptable that if a man messed around with a woman, then that woman could not get remarried. So here we see that Krishna made an exception, that he's so merciful that here at this story of Bhumasura's kidnapping all these, the daughters of all these kings, he actually married them all. And Bhumasura was actually a very, very strong, very strong demon, and he was conquering the whole world. But he went beyond. He took a little step beyond his boundary, and he stole the earrings of Aditi. And then he went and stole Varuna's umbrella. Must have been a pretty good umbrella. And then he started to make different settlements on Mount Meru. And then Indra said, "Whoa, this is getting scary," because Indra really doesn't like to see his power being challenged. So he went to Krishna and told Krishna, "Look what this demon is doing." And he has all these queens too. He went and took them all for his own lusty desire and put them in there, and something has to be done. And so Krishna said, "Oh, sounds pretty serious." So he took his wife with him, Satyabhama, with him, and they got on Garuda, and they went over to where his kingdom was. But it was not just a little palace or something that he lived in, but around the palace, this demon had gotten another demon to help make all these boundaries. So there was first a boundary of electric wires and a big canal. And then if you made it through all that, then there was this gas called Anila gas that must have been, deadly poisonous. And then there was huge walls that you had to go through, and there were guards and military behind the guards. And so Krishna said, looks pretty interesting. And so he goes there, and with his club, and his Sudarshan Chakra, he gets rid of the electric wires, he gets rid of gets go over the canal. And then he blows his conch shell. And that conch shell literally crushed the hearts of the fighters, of the military. And the sound vibration was so piercing that all the fighting instruments were just shattered. And then he got to the walls, and he took his club and just beat all the walls down. So now he's upset the Mura demon. The Mura demon who was living there comes out. He's got five heads. And so he starts to roar like a lion. And that roar was so loud that it went in 10 directions. And no one could stand that sound. And so he came out with a trident too, and he was going to poke Krishna. And so Krishna took two arrows and went zip, 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 and zipped all the five mouths of the demon. And then the Mura demon struck again, and he with a club. And so then Krishna said, "Okay, enough. You have all this arsenal, all these things here." And he just took his chakra and cut off all five heads on the ground. And so by then, Bhumasura was getting pretty upset because he was arranging for all this to happen and to protect his kingdom. And so Bhumasura comes out. And he comes out not alone. Does anybody remember what he brings with him? Elephants. And these aren't just regular elephants. Now, someone will have to tell me, but somehow or other, these elephants were special because they were raised on the seashore. Anybody know why elephants get worse when they're raised on the seashore? I don't know. I wonder if anyone knew. But they were pretty fierce elephants. And not only were they raised on the seashore, it says, but they were intoxicated. I mean, elephants are scary anyway, but an intoxicated elephant would be really scary. So anyway, he comes out with all these intoxicated elephants. And then he whips out a special artillery called a Shatagni. And that's some kind of a weapon that can just obliterate 100 people with one swipe. And so Krishna sees this, and he gets some arrows, and he shoots these arrows, and all the weapons finished. With a couple more arrows, all the fighters, the elephants are finished. And so then Bhumasura is left. And Bhumasura realizes that he gets really angry because Garuda is also fighting. So what can an eagle do? He can scratch. And so the Garuda was scratching all the elephants. He was taking his wings and hitting the fighters. And so Bulbasaur was starting to attack Garuda because he was angry with Garuda. And then that move, Krishna got really angry. You don't attack my carrier. And so he went, and Bulbasaur had a trident, was going to kill him. And Krishna, again, with his chakra, finished Bulbasaur. And Bulbasaur was actually the son of Mother Earth. And so Mother Earth came out, paid obeisances. I'm sure she was glad to get rid of her demoniac son. And she says beautiful prayers to Krishna. Many, many very nice prayers glorifying Krishna. And then Krishna takes Satyabhama and they enter the palace. And when they go in the palace, all the queen, all the captured daughters of the kings were all just, they were just captivated by Krishna. And all this time, when they were captured, they were praying, earnestly praying that, I hope Krishna will come and save us. And then when they saw Krishna, their hearts were just melted. And Krishna, and they prayed. They prayed, please, Krishna, can you marry us? What else? Besides that, we're finished. You know, our lives are done. No one will marry us. And so Krishna, out of his kindness, did so. And they took him back, and they had a beautiful ceremony on the level of all the other queens. And so this is showing how wonderful Krishna is and how he selected these very special queens. And it also shows how extraordinary Krishna is, that he is beyond any conception of any kind of a god that we could imagine. There are, this morning I think they we were reading about frauds. But actually there are many people that are envious of Krishna, of him marrying so many wives and enjoying so much. And they think, well, I can be like Krishna. But they're all frauds. And they start to marry. There are actually many gurus. Rajneesh was one. Maharishi, whatever his name was, Guru Maharaji and things like that. They thought they were Krishna. They should be like Krishna. And they started marrying many ladies. But they all ended up, I'm sure, the same thing that happened to Pondraka, who also thought he was Krishna. So we have to have great respect for Krishna, and we can, after reading such pastimes as this, so unique, and how he dealt with these activities. And here at the very end is describing how glorious these ladies were. Very selective, Krishna selected these ladies to be his queens. So they must have been very special, and many of them did very intensely pray, and they were in that mood of complete surrender to Krishna. So this is a mood. It's also a mood of love, but with a little awe and reverence, which is a different flair that Krishna has in some of the other relationships, like we heard yesterday of the damsels of Braja. Also a loving mood, but in a different way. So Krishna has so many different reciprocations and so many different relationships. It's unlimited. It's just unimaginable that every single one of us has a different relationship with Krishna. So we should learn from here that no matter what it is, Krishna is pleased with that loving mood, and he reciprocates by giving you the highest pleasure that you could ever imagine with, and be very, very, very satisfied with that reciprocation. So these are some of the recipes for real love, not lust. Not the lust of like Bulbasaur and the lust in this world of so many marriages or relationships. But it's the recipe is that you have to be, that you have to have a very soft heart, and you have to be very humble, and you have to be very submissive, and also very selfless. Not thinking about your own sense gratification, which is pretty much unheard of in the material world, because the material world is born out of lust, whereas the spiritual world is born out of love. So we can put this into practice. We're students of bhakti. We're supposed to be learning this art of loving relationships. It's a study of how to become selfless. And it begins, first of all, by taking the vow of becoming a disciple and being very submissive to whatever that guru asks you to do. And that's 24 hours a day. And then learning how to joyfully serve others. Not just serve, but to joyfully serve everybody and not expecting anything in return. And then willing to sacrifice that wanting adoration and distinction and recognition. If we can do those things, if we can practice that in this lifetime, then maybe we'll have a little bit of that intense desire to pray like these queens, to pray for becoming attached to Krishna and for him to come save us from this whole material world. So it's a matter of intensifying our desires and doing our regular things. We're not queens. We're just simple little ordinary living entities that got lost in this lusty world. So we can pray to keep our vows and to keep engaged in this process. It's a gradual process of bhakti to become selfless. And we shouldn't retire from the training. We shouldn't think, oh, now I've been doing it 20, 30, 40, 50 years. I can retire for a little while and enjoy Krishna consciousness and become a little loose in my mind and a little loose in my actions. But no retirement. We have to stay strong in our training up to the very end. And be very attentive in these teachings, even in this purport, although there's so many pastimes, but a lot of good instruction that we should read daily, and we should take to heart daily, so that we can make some advancement, and hopefully Krishna will select us to do more service next lifetime. Does anybody have any questions, comments?
I have a question.
Okay.
Are you suggesting we should endeavor to get Krishna as a husband and then get disturbed?
Should we ask for a husband from Krishna?
Yeah.
Some people have, and they've been really successful. I know of a couple in this community, that Krishna, that did austerities and asked deities for a good husband, and she got a really good one.
Ah.
I won't say who it is, but anyway. So if that's your mood, it's better than maybe going on the website and looking for one. I don't know. But Krishna knows your heart. So you just be surrendered whatever Krishna wants. And be surrendered to what his plan is. And
but then, in one angle, Krishna is reciprocating within each individual. So it's not really whatever Krishna wants. It is also our willingness, the way we want to serve him. And he is reciprocating that. Both, right?
Yeah. At some point, maybe our desires will be pure, and then there won't be any question. But right now, he's trying to help us. Mm-hmm. And so if he sees that it'll help us eventually maybe get rid of that desire, which does happen after we're married for a while, you get over that desire when the responsibility gets heavy. So yeah, Krishna will, he knows the best course of events for us. Mm-hmm. So we just have to become surrendered.
Because I just had a discussion other day with a nice few devotees, and they're all coming to the conclusion we need only mercy. Mercy is everything. But then we found actually, yes, mercy is everything, but to get the mercy, you have to endeavor. So without sadhana, without practicing, nobody got, I never saw any example that somebody got mercy without sadhana. It appears like Kaliya got mercy. But then we find he has previous three lives, he did such a severe austerity. He was that great sage, Vyadashira. Yeah. This life is just a Kaliya. Looks like without doing anything, rather it's he did abominable things. But he got the mercy. No, it was. Like
a, so we can't get lazy in this lifetime.
Correct.
We just expect mercy.
Correct.
We have to do as much service as we can possibly fit in 24 hours
correct.
Every day.
Yes. Also, there's that story you know probably in near Atlantic Bush Avenue in New York. Prabhupada was going for a morning walk and they stopped and there was a few ducks. And this man is taking a part of the bread and feeding those ducks. And some or other Prabhupada watched it from far, I guess. He said, look at this man, he's feeding that duck more. Go ask him. So they asked the man, why are you feeding that duck more? He said, because he's quacking more. Prabhupada said, we need that. So then that was very nice. It was like it really gave me in my thought for days that we have to do sadhana, practice, 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 and then it will draw attention from Krishna on pure devotee Prabhupada, and then the mercy will come.
These queens were quacking.
Yeah.
Please save us. Please save us. Hare Krishna, glory to God, Father.
Yeah. Something there on the chat. There's something on the chat, just check.
This Mother Guchit is one question from Mother Nanda.
Okay.
Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that one should be equal in praise or blame. So what is the explanation as to why he feels he needs to defend his reputation in regards to the shamataka pastime?
He also says, Yajna Charitri Stath, that he, everyone should follow, do his actions, everyone will follow a great man. So he wanted to make sure that he was stainless in his activities so that everyone would follow his great example. That's the only thing I can think of right now. Okay, have a question.